Welcome to Through the Keyhole, home of the Association of Laparoscopic Surgeons of Great Britain and Ireland podcasts, putting innovation, technology and training at the heart of modern surgery.
Hello and welcome once again to the podcast. Something that vexes us continuously is how do we treat our patients with hernias? Whether it's minimally invasively or open, decision-making is really, really important. Today I'm joined by Neil Smart, who's coming back for a second round of Through the Keyhole. He is a consultant surgeon at the Royal Devon and Exeter Hospital and a maestro with hernia repairs. This is Through the Keyhole. Neil, welcome.
Tom, thanks for having me.
Well, it's fantastic. So, what are the big issues in the world of hernias at the moment?
I think everyone has become aware of the issues surrounding medical devices generally, and I think mesh specifically. It's really come to the fore because of some of the medical legal issues regarding mesh in the pelvis from our gynecology and urology colleagues, and indeed some in colorectal.
Yeah.
But Baronessa Cumberlege's report, even though it was specific towards transvaginal mesh, had highlighted that many of the issues that she was raising were pertinent to mesh throughout the body, wherever it could be used. And that conflation, both in the lay press and in Baroness Cumberlege's report, I think has had a profound impact on how we deal specifically with our patients, how we go about consenting, what we're talking about in terms of outcomes. But it's also concentrated our minds as clinicians about why do we do hernia repairs? What is the indication? And I think for a long time, in my mind, that had got lost.
Yeah.
And people were fixing holes because there were holes there. And actually, that's not the point. The point is, it's for quality of life for the patient and to prevent the complications that come with having a hernia.
And of course, when you look at quality of life, and that's the reason you're doing it, if you do an operation that has an adverse effect, it's huge. And we were talking this afternoon with Tim Rockle about patients having hernia repairs for groin pain. And this is a real problem. And I think as a young surgeon, you know, one has to acknowledge this.
Absolutely. The golden rule of surgery, you can always make it worse.
Yeah.
And you've got to make sure that you don't do that. And it's been a thing which has perplexed me for years, is that most of the literature surrounding hernia, of whatever hernia type, most of it has centred around an outcome, which is recurrence, for which that's not necessarily why you were doing the operation. If you're doing the operation for quality of life, then the outcome that you should measure is quality of life, and it so really is.
No.
And yet our orthopaedic colleagues who do quality of life surgery with hip replacements, knee replacements, have been light years ahead of us in terms of recognising that and looking at what they should do and how they should research it and how they should evaluate implants. We as soft tissue augmenters or replacers have been way behind the curve compared to our orthopaedic colleagues.
So I would totally agree. And you've mentioned some really important points, which I'm just going to summarise for those listening. So consent is a big issue for hernia repair, and I personally use the leaflet from the British Hernia Society, which I think you were instrumental in helping design, if I'm right.
I didn't know on that one, but I know it was Andrew Dubow who was, I think, preeminent in putting that together. Right. But I think did a brilliant job,
and it's very helpful. So all my patients get that as well as their information leaflet about the specific technique. Do the operations for quality of life. So that's really, really important. And of course, always remember we can make it worse.
Mm.
And I think there's another issue which I would like to take your opinion on, and that's volume. What mm-hmm. you know, we've talked about this before, but what do you think about volume for let's take groin hernia surgery?
It's great, a great topic, and I think I'll openly acknowledge that much of my thoughts on the matter were, I suppose, crystallised by listening to Ferdinand Kockeling from Berlin, who, through the Hernia Med Registry, has been instrumental in helping us understand the relationship between volume and outcome. And I think, certainly in my mind, the situation that we found ourselves in as a country back in 2016, when all of this data was on the Royal College of Surgeons website and on the dashboards that they had on the website at the time, the average UK consultant general surgeon was doing less than 20 inguinal hernias themselves per year.
Yeah.
And I have to say, if you stop and think for a moment and go, less than 20, who would you want doing your inguinal hernia?
Mm.
Because I tell you now, someone who does less than 20 a year is not doing mine.
No, I completely agree. And I think volume really is important in this field. I think you get muscle memory. I think you make good decisions. You have a really good idea of outcome. And I think that the system is just a bit slicker.
Absolutely. I mean, and you look at the evidence that starts to come out from some of the large registries that exist in continental Europe. And yes, you need to do a minimum of 25 cases of a certain type of year to get reasonable outcomes. But if you want to start hitting what you would perceive as excellence, then the numbers go up quite a lot. And for many of them, they're saying you should be doing over 100 inguinal hernia procedures a year or more. And if I was going to have my inguinal hernia done, I would want to go to someone who was passionate about it, understood the anatomy, knew what they were doing, and had a high volume practice, and it was what they wanted to do. I wouldn't want someone who was going to be a have a go hero and just tack it on the end of their morning list or their list of what other else that they're doing, yeah, just as an afterthought. That's not really acceptable anymore. And I think the concept behind specialisation, particularly for hernia repair, very much more well developed on the continent, I think is probably going to have to come to the NHS.
I think the pandemic has given us such a backlog that this is a great opportunity for us to reorganise and do something really good. And it's important that the right people hear this. And it's also important that our junior colleagues understand that key point that you said about measuring quality of life. And you made another really, really, really pertinent point, which is, look at what the orthopaedic surgeons do. You know, they've got registries, they've got outcome data, and they also have a system to help people who perhaps may fall outside funnel plots. Mm. And I think it would be very nice to be able to ensure that we have that sort of system. So that's the groin hernias. Something that's much more complicated is are the hernias on the abdominal wall, and I've had the pleasure of working with you. Obviously, we work together at Colchester, and we've talked about not just the incisional hernias but also the peristomal hernias. So, very brief, I'm going to ask you about both of those.
Mm-hmm.
Can you just give me a brief overview of your current thinking about abdominal wall? So I'm going to ask you quick fire questions.
Mm-hmm.
What do you think about pre-operative Botox? What do you think about what do you think is a reasonable type of mesh to put into your repair? And what are your views on binders?
Botox, probably yes. Tend to use it when defects are difficult to give a precise measurement, obviously, because it depends upon the size of the individual, whether they're a 50 kilogram woman versus a 150 kilogram man. Obviously, there's quite marked differences between the two, but usually defects greater than 8 centimeters, we look towards using Botox injection. It's done by one of my anaesthetic colleagues who does it all under ultrasound guidance, absolutely brilliantly.
And 8 weeks beforehand?
Somewhere around, anywhere between 4 to 8 weeks, and it just depends upon how our theatre scheduling works, but yeah, within that time window is 4 to 8 weeks afterwards is when you would want to operate. And many of the patients know that they can feel the muscles start to relax and they feel a stretching sensation, yeah, from about 2 weeks onwards. I know that there are going to be newer variants of the Botox injection on the market which act quicker and within days, yeah, but at the moment we don't have access to them, so we're on the older versions with the brand names of Botox or Dysport, like, yeah, most UK hospitals, I should imagine.
Okay, mesh.
For most scenarios, the common or garden macroporous,
yep,
synthetic permanent material is likely to be the mesh of choice for most patients. It will do really well in most scenarios and it will do what you want. The expensive meshes, which are either synthetic absorbable meshes, mm-hmm, biologic meshes, they're really quite niche market products. Yeah. I use them. I don't use a lot of them. I don't use them often, but I still think they've got a place. But for the majority of the time, your straightforward polypropylene or polyester meshes, which have got appropriate pore size for ingrowth, are going to be where your win is at.
Okay. Transfacial sutures or glue?
Depends on the context, but if you're doing a straightforward Reeve stopper, there's a good question to be asked, do you need any fixation at all? And just the pressure of the abdominal wall layers when everything's closed will keep it in place. I've tended to move away from transfacial sutures over recent years because of the issues surrounding catching nerves causing chronic pain.
Yeah, really, really important. Chronic pain is a real big issue, isn't it?
Yeah.
Binders? Well, before we get to binders, drain?
I do. I leave them in for a couple of days to take away the seroma fluid in the immediate post-operative period. After that, do they make a difference? Difficult to say. I think if people are going to form a seroma, it's probably driven by factors other than a drain.
Yeah.
And the issue about tissue injury, genomics, and all that side of things is likely to be relevant, but is currently poorly understood. Do we use binders? Not specifically, and often we would give patients binders. And when I was starting out, I used to give patients binders, and then I discovered that most of them sit in the bottom of the underwear drawer and don't get worn because they find them too uncomfortable, too painful.
So sit in the underwear drawer, or they end up being a belt sort of somewhere in the midriff.
Yeah, so I've tended to say to patients that if they want something, I think there are better products on the market. I don't think we've got good evidence to recommend any one brand over another, but things like some of the compression underwear,
yep,
that you can get, or the compression vest. And many of the patients, particularly who've got peristomal hernias, swear by some of the compression vests. I think they're the best thing since sliced bread. So they often provide support which is more comfortable and more likely to get used. So
okay, and a shout out for your supplier of choice.
So it depends who's buying it and in what context. For the majority of patients who've got straightforward incisional hernia stuff, many I just send them to the local high street, to any of the cheaper shops on the high street, yep, where stuff is just as effective as going for the expensive stuff from John Lewis Partnership or Spanx or, yep, one of those really eye-watering expensive brands. The parastomal stuff is slightly different. You know, there are a number of suppliers out there, including people like Vanilla Blush, who will do things which are more tailored. So lots of patients find it much more patient-friendly, more patient-orientated. Okay, but different strokes for different folks, and there's lots of stuff out there now, so patients should be able to have a look and choose what they want.
Okay, that's an important bit of knowledge to pass on. And parastomal hernias, so our abdominal walls were not made to have holes in them, full stop. And parastomal hernia, you know, as you, I love your saying, if you follow up a patient long enough, the parastomal hernia rate is 100%.
Yeah.
So let's start with, so I put in a prophylactic mesh for my abdominoperineals. Any opinions, and what mesh would you use?
So I can say that in the CIFER study, for all patients of any type of stoma, less than 3% received a prophylactic mesh.
Right.
And I think it was about 80 out of nearly 2,500 patients had a prophylactic mesh. And of those, I think there were less than a dozen surgeons were responsible for inserting those 80 meshes, and there was one surgeon who was responsible for about half of the insertions, and that was me.
Right. Good.
So I do put in prophylactic mesh for patients who are going to have a permanent end colostomy.
And is this
rectal cancer?
Okay. And is this based on B.B. Hansen?
It's based on the balance of probabilities, and then people have often misunderstood my points, because I've always been quite cynical about the fact that some of the early randomized controlled trials claimed that prophylactic mesh prevented parastomal hernia, and I don't think it does. And certainly the most recent high quality trials, whether it's from two from Sweden, one from France, both have in fact demonstrated that parastomal hernia is not prevented by prophylactic mesh. But I think the wrong questions have been asked, because again, we're back to the concept of quality of life rather than occurrence or recurrence. So for me, it's not about does it prevent parastomal hernia, because I'm not certain you can prevent parastomal hernia, because if you follow the patient up long enough, it will occur. But the question is, can you slow the rate at which it occurs? Can you reduce the size of the hernia that occurs as a result of having mesh inside you? Do they cause fewer symptoms, and are they less likely to come to corrective surgery? And if you ask those questions, then I think we will see, when some of those trials have the opportunity to analyse their data in more detail, that that is indeed what happens. So if you ask, do you get fewer parastomal hernias with prophylactic mesh, the answer will be no. But are the hernias smaller, less symptomatic, less likely to need an operation, and do they take longer to appear? I think the answer is yes.
Okay. And the type of mesh?
Again, straightforward. Macroporous, permanent, synthetic.
Synthetic. Meshes. And no problems with erosion, infection?
It hasn't happened to me yet, but that's only because I haven't done enough.
Yeah.
I'm sure it will come one day. That's part of the consent process that the patients have to go through. But the data from all the RCTs, and particularly the high-quality RCTs now, have demonstrated that the rates of infection are no higher with mesh insertion, and they haven't had any cases of erosion or fistulation. Okay. And the numbers of patients who've had mesh that's needed to be removed has been very, very, very low. I think the one message that we should get from those trials is that mesh use is safe in that context.
Good. Okay. And finally, para-ileostomy hernia repair, parastomal hernia repair, I think, paracolostomy. I think maybe have to be approached slightly differently. Would you agree? Or do you...
That, and on top of that, paraurostomy.
Yeah.
Hernia repair. The paraurostomy hernias are perhaps some of the most challenging because of the tethering of the ileal conduit to the posterior abdominal wall where you get the anastomosis to the ureters. Usually very difficult.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, they're challenging.
And principles? So
I still don't know what the best repair is, which is why, along with Sue Blackwell and Tom Pinckney, the PROFOS study is on the horizon to help try and collate information to help answer those questions. Because I still am not certain that I know what the right operation to do is.
Yeah, I love your approach that, that everything should be very controlled and scientifically analysed, which is, of course, what we should be doing as modern-day surgeons.
It's the easiest thing in the world to say, oh, this technique's the one. And actually, in 5 years' time, it might well turn out to be it's absolutely the one which causes most carnage. And we don't know. We just don't know.
Well, we were laughing, weren't we, over lunch about, it changes very quickly and it often only takes a year for you to realise to ditch the repair.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it takes a brave person to sit there and say, actually, we've tried this, we've looked at our data, and you know what? It didn't work. And in fact, if anything, it caused problems. And so, you know, having that data and driving continuous improvement is going to be really key. And we need to be honest with patients that I don't think we know what the best operation is.
Those are wise words. And just a brief word about the EHS, the European Hernia Society scoring system. Would you commend that to our young listeners?
So I think I'd recommend, well, first of all, I would say to surgeons in training, if they've got an interest in hernia generally, that they should join the British Hernia Society because it's free. Mm-hmm. Secondly, European Hernia Society, I strongly recommend joining. Great organisation. It's cheap to join for trainees.
Yeah.
And it is a great organisation for doing education and training surrounding hernia. They've done lots of work over the past 15 years trying to do recommendations, guidelines and classification systems so that we can talk a common language. Much of that work has been led by some great surgeons, and the concept of having a classification so we can talk a common language is great. My only concern about it is the development methodologically perhaps wasn't quite as robust as it might have been.
Right.
And the validity of any of the classification systems can sometimes be difficult, because if you have sharp cutoffs, say greater or smaller than 5 centimetres, do we really have any good evidence to suggest that a hernia with a defect of 4.9 centimetres is materially different from something with 5.1 centimetres? Yeah. I would postulate that we don't, and it's not. That can be the same entity. So,
yeah, no, really, really important points. So is the BHS planning a meeting in the coming months?
So I think British Hernia Society next meeting is going to be in Manchester in 2022, along with European Hernia Society meeting, which is there. Ali Sheen is the local organiser, and I've had a brief word from him about some of the things that he's planning. It's going to sound really exciting, and I hope anyone who's got an interest in hernia surgery will be there. Manchester's a fantastic city to have a congress in. Lots to see, lots to do. There should be some great speakers, so I'm really looking forward to it.
And do you know when, roughly, is it?
They have recently rearranged the date because of the COVID restrictions. Right. I'd have to double check.
Yeah. Okay. Brilliant. Well, Neil, as always, fantastic to talk to you. We've covered a lot of ground. And I think, there's a lot of food for thought. So thank you very much, Neil Smart.
Absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's a pleasure.
Keyhole. You will find more interesting podcasts in this series, as well as online resources from the ALS GBI at www.alsgbi.org.